Blog Talk Radio.
This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder for those that are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. If you have comments, observations, or if you have a question you think is more important than the questions that Eagle One and I are asking, please let us know in the chat room, and we will do best to bring that into the program. If you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some of the previous shows, or if you have to leave halfway through the show and want to see what you missed, you can always listen to the archive shows over at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you have an iPad, iPhone, something, another MP3 player, you can subscribe and download the free podcast over on iTunes. And let's move on with the show. It often has been said, with crisis comes opportunity, that any organization that is under external stress, it has an opportunity there with the right leadership and vision to look at itself, reform itself, and move forward in a better direction than you could be when you're complacent and unchallenged. And as the traditional Western powers are under a debt struggle unprecedented in any type of peacetime situation, that's going to force stresses on defense budgets and naval budgets in particular because of the large ticket items a lot of them represent. And even amongst the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, for a variety of reasons, mostly economic, resource, and demographics, they're under stress as well. So we're in a real dynamic period when it comes to defense budgets in the global national security scheme. And there's technology coming on board that enhances old platforms, makes other ones obsolete. A very dynamic time to be in this field. And I think to talk about this, we have a returning guest today, Eric Wertheim, that I think just is a spot-on opportunity to talk about all these issues. For those that aren't aware of Eric's background, he's a defense consultant, also a columnist, and an author specializing in naval and maritime issues. For a politician, which he is not, most people have as a reference Michael Barone's irreplaceable Almanac of American Politics. Well, if you're interested in anything naval, there is something that Eric's been at the helm of since 2002. That's the one-volume Naval Institute reference guide, Combat Fleets of the World. And this isn't a pocketbook. This isn't a Cliff Notes version. This isn't something you can skim through or put in 140 characters. This is what we call a tome, a little audio here on the desk. I just blew out an eardrum. That is the book. It is unquestionably the touchstone if you have a question about what type of frigates Greece has, or you know, the Libyans, what did they actually get hold of after their revolution? Or when we had the crisis in Georgia, and we were hearing about the Russians going after the Georgian fleet. I had no idea what type of ships they had. I could find out in the volume. He does more than that, though. He also has written from 1994 to 2004, he wrote the bi-monthly Lest We Forget column on historic U.S. warships for the Naval Institute's Proceedings magazine. And since that time, he has also written the Combat Fleets column for Proceedings, and his annual review of world navies runs in the March issue of the magazine. He also has a partnership that I think anybody in the naval side of the house would love to have. He has worked with Norman Pollmar with the books Chronology of the Cold War at Sea from 1945 to 1991, and also the book Dictionary of Military Abbreviations, which makes a great Christmas present for your family member after a couple of deployments. They can actually understand what you're talking about. And another unique background that I'm going to kind of tap Eric on the shoulder with and ask them to talk to us before we get into the finer details of the fleet, is Eric has been at this really from about the earliest I think somebody can. He started writing for the Naval Institute Press at age 18 and has been a columnist with Proceedings since the age of 19. Eric, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you so much for having me. Wow, that was a great introduction.
Well, thanks for giving me the luxury of giving a little more than I usually do.
Sure, that's about my life story there. It's really great to be back. I listen to your show each week, and so I'm glad to be another returning guest.
Perfect. And I wanted, like I mentioned in the intro, before we dive off into some of the fleet details, and we kind of talked about this a little bit before the show, but you really, if like many of our listeners and readers are, if you're a history geek, if you're a naval geek, if you need to know the details, if you want to be able to speak confidently, you really have a dream gig on what you do. But you didn't get there by accident. You started early, you've worked hard, and you've produced quality product that people have a demand for. And one thing that we've talked amongst a few people is how we get young people who are either naval professionals who are interested in maritime issues, how do you get them to write? A lot of them say, well, and I know this will make you go, I'm only 23, 24, I don't really know enough to write about. What would you tell these young men and women who just seem to have a little bit of self-confidence, a little bit of writer's block, who you look at and you go, God, you got a good brain, you'd be a good writer. What would you do to encourage them to give it a shot?
Yeah, I think that it's so important today because it's not always encouraged. And I think that the active involvement in whatever it is your passion is, whether it's Navy, Air Force, Armed Forces, medical, science, whatever it could be, encourage young people to be involved. Because what happened was, and what happened with me, and I'm sure what happens with a lot of people in their teens, they start to develop interests. And I was very fortunate in that my family, my parents very much encouraged my interest in ships and navies and learning about this kind of stuff, so much so that when I was about 15 or 16, I subscribed to the Naval Institute's Proceedings magazine, and I saw an advertisement that said, all anti-submarine warfare professionals are invited to attend a conference in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Naval Institute. I convinced my family to take a vacation to Washington, and I signed up, and they dropped me off at that conference. They said, if you really have the guts to do this, we'll drop you off. And I brought my suit with me on the vacation, and that's where a lot of it started for me, was that I got to meet the editor-in-chief of Proceedings and the director of the press, and it was just this amazing thing, because when people are young, the greatest thing about being young is you're allowed to make mistakes, say dumb things, ask lots of questions, and people understand that's part of the process. And everyone is so helpful and great about it. And so the Naval Institute was such a great organization for me, and because what they did was they worked out a deal where I, of course, couldn't afford to keep going to these conferences. So what they did was worked out a deal where I would volunteer at the events, help them set up and break down the conferences and go to all different events with them. And in turn, they'd let me to go for free, and I'd help with membership drives and things like that. And it was such a great opportunity because they would give me some of their old textbooks and things like that. They'd put me in touch with some of the authors or Naval Academy professors, and I would get some of the textbooks and go through them. And it became like I was being tutored by some of the world's experts on this subject. And so as I went through high school and my undergrad degree in college, this kind of continued to work. And in my sophomore year, I interned during the summers in college for the Naval Institute. And during my sophomore year, they offered me to work on a book with Norman Palmore. And then again the next year, and I started writing this magazine column for Proceedings. And it all really happened because people kept encouraging me, and they didn't kind of make it like I don't know what I'm talking about. There probably were times where I didn't know what I was talking about, but they worked with me so that I learned. And they'd get me out on ships and submarines so that I learned this stuff. And I think one of the biggest things is I did not try to look like I knew everything. And a lot of times kids and teenagers and even younger people, they don't want to admit they don't know stuff. Still to this day, I'm the first one to ask questions. And I really encourage anyone who works around young kids or who are older kids or who's listening to keep asking those questions and be as involved as possible and really have some courage to go out, try something like this, do an intern, do, you know, it wasn't a process where it was something that I knew where I was going to go. This was just one opportunity, and it really allowed me to see where I wanted to go. So I really encourage you. Yep.
How did you get from there to becoming the master and commander of this Bible of naval information? You know, you didn't walk into it one day and they said, "Oh, by the way, we want to take over this combat fleet to the world." What was the process by which you came to be the in charge of that?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting because what happened was I worked for my first job out of college was actually for Janes, which is my friendly competitor, but I helped them with their marketing, and my job was to help them sell all of their naval books, which at the time was, you know, fighting ships and major warships, all kinds of maritime propulsion, all those kind of books that they were selling, naval weapon systems. Those books, I had to learn how to market and sell them. So I worked there for a year. I really, really didn't like it for a number of reasons. And I stayed, of course, in touch with the Naval Institute, kept writing for proceedings. And then what happened was after I left there, I started doing independent consulting. And I really learned a lot of different things. I worked for the Naval Institute. I worked with the Navy League. I worked with all different kinds of organizations, the Naval Historical Foundation and Naval Historical Center, and kind of worked on all different kinds of stuff. And from there, what happened was I was able to keep learning, keep getting hands-on information. And then what happened was that I started doing consulting. I kept writing for the Naval Institute, kept doing consulting. And I, you know, would be learning. I was going to all of these events, staying involved on everything that was happening, and staying up on this stuff as best as possible. I did not in any way consider myself a world's expert, but what happened was my predecessor, A.D. Baker III, is one of the people in this field I respect so much, and he had done combat fleets of the world from the 1970s till 2001, and he decided that he wanted to retire, and I had no news of this, and I was at a conference one day with the Naval Institute, and Admiral Marfiak, who was then at that time the director of the Naval Institute, the head of the Naval Institute, put his arm around me and was joking that Eric Wertheim, he's going to be the next editor of Combat Fleets. I didn't know what he was talking about, and I went home, I remember, and I thought that was really strange. A couple people had said something about it. So I called the Institute, talked to the secretary, who, of course, had known me since I was 16, and I said, "Why is everyone saying that?" And they said, "Well, A.D. Baker, Dave Baker, has decided to retire, and there's a short list, and you are at the top of the short list." I said, I don't know if I can do that. This is just such an immense job." And so, well, they said, "Do you want us to take your name off the list?" I said, "No, just leave it on." Well, they kept narrowing down the list, and finally they offered me the job, and I decided, you know what, this is just a dream come true. This is something that, even though I'm not there yet, I really wanted to take this and do the best I could with it. And I said to them, "I'm not sure I'm the right one. Are you sure?" And they said, "Listen, this is more about taking a big project from start to finish than anything else. You will learn to be able to go out there and be the world's expert, to go on the news, to do that kind of stuff." Because that was my worry. I was thinking, I'm not ready to do that. They said, "That'll come with time." And that's one of those things that I had to kind of learn, and I'm still learning how to work that kind of element. Because there's so much to do in combat fleets that's more than just putting a book together.
And that's a perfect lead-in to a question I wanted to ask you next, Garrett, Eric. Yeah, I'm sure every edition you do, the world is always changing. Things are always coming on and leaving, and you have to keep things updated. But when you look at the major navies of the world, all those countries' budgets are under a tremendous amount of stress. There's also some new technology coming on, and things are changing on a rapid basis. What system do you have in place to keep everything up to date and as accurate as possible, so when that next edition hits the street, so to speak, it's that as accurate as can be, snapshot in time?
Yeah, the biggest thing I do is I try not to throw any news away. So thankfully, computers make my life a lot easier. I don't know what people did, what my predecessor did before the internet, but what happens is every day new news comes in, whether it's from the Navy's Chimfo clips or from Proceedings magazine or anywhere it could be. I have networks of people all over the world that monitor stuff and send it to me. And of course, if readers are listening, feel free. You can go to combatfleets.com and get in touch with me and send me any kind of news you think might be helpful. Photographs are another element. And so naval photographers all around the world who happen to be on merchant ships or anywhere in ports, and they see a ship coming into port, they take some pictures, send it my way, and try and make them high res if you can. And what I'm able to do then is look at those ships, see the changes from the last ships that have gone. So, for instance, if someone says, I need to see a picture of X warship in 2007, and I need to see it again in July 2008, I might be able to get that, track that down and look through my file so I can say, here's when the change was made. Here's when they decided to put a towed array sonar on, or here's when they decided to take this specific air search radar off. That kind of thing is so much a part of my work and so much a part of tracking down where I can kind of collect this intelligence, where it's like a private intelligence service is really what it is. So that's a lot of what I do. You know, that's a lot of how I kind of put it together. I think that answered the question.
Yeah, sure does. Eagle One.
Yeah, with your private intelligence service, some fleets, I guess, are going to be more active than others as far as information going. So as you look ahead to, I guess, the 2012 edition, what fleets do you see as, you know, are making the biggest changes, and you'll have the most work to do to get ready for the next issue?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Japan is always one that's very interesting, and I just finished working on the Japan chapter. One of the things is that Japanese Navy is very, very – their ships are very young, so they don't keep their – most of their frontline warships are only in service for maybe 20 years or so before they retire them, and so they always have lots of changes in the Japanese Navy. Their stuff is very high-tech, and they're always building new classes of ships and submarines, and now for the first time, you know, they have this very, very large helicopter carrier that is, you know, it's really a helicopter-carrying destroyer, they call it for political reasons, but it's a very capable addition to their fleet. They're building a couple of those. Of course, the Pacific region has had such growth. China's Navy, the Chinese chapter is going to look entirely different for the next edition, because there's just been so much information, so much change from their aircraft carrier development to the range of air defense warships they now have in service and that they're building, new amphibious ships the Chinese are building. And, of course, you have countries all around that area. Vietnam has had a lot of updates, and so they're getting new ships from Russia. Thailand is very seriously considering the acquisition of submarines. They really thought they had finalized it, but now they're having some budgetary pressures. So that's got a lot. And I think some of the other things, like, for instance, the Italian Coast Guard. You know, Italy has had a large number of changes, and the Italian Coast Guard has so many small ships in it, and some large ships as well, that those countries are very, very difficult to trace, and a lot of hours goes into making it as accurate as possible. It's, but I can tell you that the changes are just amazing. One of the changes some of the changes I always think about is that it takes really 10 years for a ship to kind of come from an idea to a real ship, you know, from concept to reality, and many times even longer. And so it's going to be very interesting to see where some of this stuff goes. You know, you see tremendous cutbacks in the British fleet, The French fleet has been doing very, very well in terms of their capability, has been really growing by leaps and bounds in the past 10 years, so much so that they're kind of in a new renaissance now. They have their Aquitaine class of Frem frigates. They have their Horizon destroyers. They have, of course, their aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle. So there's so many different things to cover. The Germans, for many years, had a lot of growth, but we're seeing that it's starting to kind of slow down a little, and their navy's kind of starting to cut back on some of the new construction that we've seen. So those are just some of the samplings. Of course, every country has its own story of how much has been changing.
Speaking of Japan, this show is not sponsored by the Naval Institute. However, if you look at the December of 2011 edition of Naval History, Jonathan Parshall and J. Michael Winger, they have a great article in there for those that think they know everything about Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor's Overlooked Answer. And I think they pulled together a lot of threads that people have probably read elsewhere, and they draw a pretty neat line on, Pearl Harbor wasn't so much an American disaster as a Japanese success in this respect, that back in 1940, you talk about your little intelligence record and making sure people send you photos and everything. Back in 1940, then Lieutenant Commander Genda, he saw a newsreel of a passing review parade of four American carriers in a box, which for a good little lieutenant commander who hadn't had his will broken yet, that put a seed in his head where he went, what happens if everybody has carriers, the French, the Americans, the British, and we have carriers. They use them for scouting. This is what they traditionally use them for. And that was about the time, the British did their swordfish strike on the Italian fleet, but that was just one carrier at night with, I think, 12 or 24 aircraft. And he said, what would happen if instead of that, you brought them all together and massed the aircraft? And, of course, he got TEP Oval support when they did the first Japanese fleet arm. And so you had in that short period of time, there was a platform. It wasn't a new platform. It didn't have a bunch of new stuff on it. It had been around 10, 15 years. A lot of navies had the same capabilities. But it was just the Japanese who were the first ones to really get it on what carriers could do when concentrated. When you're looking at the changes that are coming globally with the different fleets and not necessarily new technology, but technology, weapon systems, tactics that a lot of people have, but certain nations are kind of getting an idea of do something new and more powerful with it. Do you see anything out there, whether it's from involving submarines or BMD or satellites? Is there something that certain nations really seem to be gelling on?
Yeah, the first thing that you mentioned was submarines. Submarines are just proliferating like crazy in certain regions of the world. Every country seems to have a desire to acquire them, and they really are have a very significant impact on the naval realm, because even just one submarine in the area just complicates things very, very much for a surface force. And so that area, that dynamic is really changing a lot. So anti-submarine warfare, which had really been not an area of focus in the past 10 years, really between, 2000 to today, is now it's starting to come back in some ways in importance. And I think it's one of the most important things for our forces to look at, because it's just going to be essential. Anytime you have capital ships on the surface, they're going to be vulnerable to submarines, and we really have to get back into the business of protecting our assets. We have, for instance, gotten rid of the S-3 Viking from the aircraft carriers, from the carrier air wings, and we've really scaled back on some of our anti-submarine warfare capabilities. So I think this rise in submarines is really going to have some significant impacts.
Is that rise in submarines matched by a rise in mine warfare, or is that just an ongoing situation?
Well, mine warfare historically has been the area since, for instance, World War II, where the most damage has been done to U.S. Navy warships. If you look at in you know, the things like the Sam Roberts and you know, a lot of incidents like that, that historically has been where we've suffered our casualties. I think a lot of these areas are areas that have significantly been overlooked. You know, they're not as sexy as the anti-ship missiles or air defense systems or fighters. But, you know, China in particular pays very, very close attention to mine warfare. That's really one of their strengths. And, you know, they have a very big emphasis on that. Their submarines play a very big role conducting mine warfare, whereas ours really are used for different things, from, you know, intelligence collection, anti-ship, land attack, things like that. Their submarines, in many ways, are used very prolifically as mine layers. So I think that that's they go hand in hand in many ways, because these are areas that the U.S. Navy and our allies are particularly vulnerable in, and they're areas that are often overlooked. So I do think, though, we've also overlooked a lot of the conventional missions that a Navy does, the anti-air, anti-surface, and anti-sub. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we're going to face in the future, because we've been so concentrated on transformation and small wars that the rest of the world, in many ways, has caught up in terms of anti-ship missile technology and things like that. So I think we're going to have our work cut out for us in terms of Navy acquisition when they look at weapon systems.
You know, Eric, you're exactly right, and it is such an unforced error. And a lot of it has to do for exactly the wrong reasons. It all was Rice Bowl, a lot of it, not all of it. A lot of it was Rice Bowl issues. It was politics. It was flag officers more in love with their background as opposed to their fleet. I think, and this predates 9/11, but it was part of that, quote, transformation, unquote, never define what you're transforming into, where they said, well, let's see, submarines and mines, they're both underwater. Let's just put them together in the same command. So you lost that advocacy. That it's really a shame, because you're exactly right. History shows what a danger that is. Coming up to a little more recent history, we had a guest, Michael Baraton, we talked in some detail about Libya and some of the lessons or reminders that especially our European allies, and you really have to tap into the European and the French language press to be able to get a lot of the good discussions that are taking place about it. But the experience in Libya, not just, wow, aircraft carriers are kind of handy experience, but I know the Chinese had a wake-up call when they needed to evacuate some of their nationals. Even we had a wake-up call when we had to evacuate some people from other places in North Africa. Have you seen, as you keep your pulse on the maritime world for your next edition, have you seen some major bold-faced items that have percolated up from nations' experience in Libya that may impact shipbuilding or fleet planning for a lot of these nations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Libya has had a huge impact on the kind of the small carriers and the what exactly these ships can do. And I think you saw some really amazing things. You saw the fact that there were, for instance, one of the things is there were aircraft conducting, close air support. For instance, French aircraft, up till the very end, you saw the French aircraft conducting strikes against Muammar Gaddafi, the last phases before he was killed. And I think that a lot of times people think, oh, if you do good enough interdiction, you don't need this kind of support. If you, you target their centers of gravity or you do this kind of stuff, well, sometimes you're going to need that kind of support, that ability to do that. And that's one of the things that the U.S. Marine Corps, of course, specializes in. And I think that in many ways, the Marine Corps role in this and the role of the amphibious assault ship standing off when there was not an aircraft carrier in the region from the United States has a lot of significant implications. And I think one of the implications is for the Joint Strike Fighter and the future of the F-35B Bravo model, which is the short takeoff and vertical landing, or the F-35C, the conventional carrier takeoff, which is not a short takeoff platform. So I think that kind of issue, you're going to see it has major ramifications, because I think actually that if the F-35B, the Stovall version, survives, it will be largely because of these types of the successes of the Libyan operation, where there was not a U.S. carrier in the region for the majority of the time, and there was, in fact, smaller carriers able to conduct the operation.
Well, one of the other things that interested me in the Libya operation was the use of, by the French of naval surface gunnery to aid in some of their operations. Does this indicate that there may be a revival or a rethinking of naval surface fire support for actions ashore? And do you see that in any of the patterns that you look at as you put your book together?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that there is going to be an increase in naval gunfire support, but the difference is it's not going to be the type of we know it. We're going to instead see GPS-guided munitions. We're going to see that it's going to exist, but it's going to be guided and precision, so that it's going to be extended ranges. So that's really what we're going to, I think, going to be seeing more in the future, because we're in an environment today where you don't want to send unguided artillery anymore. It's too dangerous from a political standpoint. Now, there are, of course, going to be situations where you have good enough accurate information and you're just bombarding a camp, let's say, an enemy camp. But for the most part, there's been a massive shift in terms of the funding, and it's really been going to the more accurate GPS-type guided munitions. I think that's going to be very, very important. And the Europeans are looking at it. The Americans are looking at it. And I think within the next 10 years, it's really going to be operational. I'm not sure if other navies in the Asian countries are going to be as interested in it, because it's not something that they the accuracy of their munitions in terms of fire support is not so much a requirement for them. But for us, where you very often need that support before you go into a hostile area, I think it's going to be very important. And I think one of the big debates that we're going to be seeing in the next very short-term future is going to be this debate that I talked about before, the F-35B versus the F-35C. And I think that the F-35B, in my opinion, brings a lot to the fight that a lot of people disagree with me, but it gives a lot of unique capabilities that I think can really add to the equation. You know, I think recently the Commandant of the Marine Corps was interviewed in Sea Power magazine and gave some really interesting analysis where he talked about why F-35B is important. He talked about, that you have 11 major aircraft carriers in the U.S. Navy, but if you have F-35B, that turns them into 22, because you can use all your amphibious assault ships. It just creates a lot of capability that you wouldn't have. The other thing that the F-35B's got going for it is that you have countries like the Italians and the French and the Indians that have smaller carriers that have the Harrier right now, but after the Harrier retires, there's just no game in town other than the F-35B. So that's kind of got it going for it too.
You know, Eric, what you mentioned right there is one thing that I haven't heard enough people of influence argue for the 35. I'm like you. I think the 35 Bravo, it is the most important of the three versions for a variety of reasons. But that if it costs an extra 20%, I don't care. We've got all our eggs in one basket. We might as well focus on the basket. But the 35 Bravo is so important for this reason, if nothing else. Our allied nations and friendly nations that now operate the Harrier are going to need a replacement. When they have these decks, any type of combined naval force, it makes their contributions better. And if they're flying 35 Bravos, that means that their officers have to come to the U.S. for training. It starts building those relationships. I've talked to so many flag officers. A U.S. Army officer I knew in Europe, he knew the guy who was the chief of staff in the Turkish Armed Forces, because they've known each other since they were JOs. It builds those professional relationships. It's such an incredible catalyst to be able to do that. Hopefully on the 35 Bravo, all those problems are fixed, because it really is a long pole and the Lightning II tent from my point of view. In kind of changing the subject a bit, is when you look at a lot of discussions on the American fleet, it almost seems that from a surface point of view, we have what we've seen in Libya. It's a reminder of the importance of naval surface fire support. And I've been an advocate of the general purpose gun since before I was even in the Navy. I remember after the Falkland Islands War, the British experience with they were literally shooting the liners out of their barrels, and the ships that didn't have guns were of little use to them. That's going to have a renaissance. But when you look at our overall focus, whether you're talking about SM-2, SM-3, anti-ballistic missile defense, anti-swarm defenses for ships, we seem to be very, very defensive-minded, where offensive weapons, if you're talking about anti-surface warfare of some kind, are creating effects ashore, everybody defaults to the carrier. Well, let's say we go down to 8 carriers in a few years. We're going to have a lot more surface ships going without air. And what if they have to get into a punching match with somebody else? What do they have to throw at them at any range? A harpoon, the height of 1970s technology that's been upgraded a little bit? Because there are some other anti-surface weapons out there that potential adversaries have that really are two generations ahead of harpoon. Do you see any indication on the American side that, at least in the surface Navy, we're going to try to get a little more battle-minded and offensive-focused as opposed to hoping that the 1310s are going to save the day?
That is a million-dollar question. I mean, that really is huge because we have not been investing. And there's just, a couple years back, there was the next generation of a Harpoon missile that was being developed that was going to be able to engage surface and land targets, and it was canceled. There were some delays and problems with the data link, and they just decided to cancel it. So I'm not very confident that we will get a next-generation anti-ship missile anytime soon. In the meantime, some of our allies are just going their own way and developing their own weapons. Even Japan has developed its own anti-ship missile. And so I think that, we're seeing that continue, and we're seeing that China and Iran are developing and working on some very advanced anti-ship missile technology. China in particular is working on them, and Iran's producing copies. Russia, India has the BrahMos working with Russia. These are all very, very advanced weapon systems. And the reason that we are funding and investing so much in the defensive capability is just for this purpose, to counter some of these. But from an offensive capability, we're relying very, very heavily. We continue to rely very heavily on carrier air and the naval aviation capability. But it would be very nice if you talk to surface cruiser destroyer guys, it would be very nice to give them with a weapon worthy of their ships. And I think that's a real challenge that we face. And I hope it's addressed, but I'm not confident. I think we really need to do something. But I think the funding is many years away still from having a program like that really produce a real weapon. LCS is a perfect example. I'm very concerned about LCS because it doesn't answer some of these questions that the challenges we're facing.
Well, I'm glad you raised the LCS because that was my next question. What in the world are we going to do with those ships?
You know, it's really strange because it's answering a call for something that we don't necessarily have this tremendous requirement for. Certainly, we have a need for mine warfare and for anti-submarine warfare and for all the other types of operations that LCS are going to be able to do. But my concern about LCS is that it's replacing frigates, but it doesn't have the capabilities of a frigate, and they will be put in harm's way, but they won't have those capabilities. And then the other problem is when you look at, let's say, a destroyer or even a frigate, that frigate or destroyer is multipurpose. So it can go from air defense to anti-ship to whatever it is, and it doesn't have to go back to port to swap its weapons capability, whereas the LCS has to actually go back into port, swap its capability, and come back out. And my concern is that it's not, even though they call it multipurpose, it's not really multi-purpose simultaneously. And so that's a big concern. You know, a couple months ago, Gibbs & Cox, the designer of one of the LCSs, unveiled a light frigate design. And this really
It's nice.
Answers
I liked it. Yep.
Yeah, I think nice. there was a lot of potential. And I no one even kind of gave it a second thought because they were too worried that if they looked at another design, they looked at anything else, change anything in this budget environment, they'd be slammed down for it. Well, that's really too bad because that could have wound up saving money in the long term. Now, maybe it still can. Maybe in the future something will happen. But I can't imagine the Navy going through and buying all these LCSs when they really aren't meeting completely the requirement that's needed for surface ships. Now, 10 ships, sure, that's fine. We can use them for ASW and mine countermeasures. But there's so many challenges that are being faced that I don't think that LCS is going to answer the call, and I do think that it would be wise to look further at a light frigate design like Gibbs & Cox unveiled. I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, I don't think I'm in 100% agreement with you. One of the only good things I see about LCS is that that ship will maybe survive 20 years and will have to be replaced. I don't think until you get a Secretary of Defense and a Secretary of the Navy that are ready to take out a broad axe and just gut some people and replace them with other people, we're not going to see that movement because there's too many people's egos wrapped up in it that they're not willing to. And in the end, sadly, we're going to have sailors on this 50-something number of ships, and they're going to come up against be asked to do things that they're just – the ship is not able to do, but they're just going to have – they're just there, so they're going to have to do it. And sailors don't wind up dead.
You're absolutely right. That's the biggest concern I have is that we're using them to replace warships that were multipurpose, but these are not able to do those same jobs. They're not able to do the roles of a frigate. Yet they're probably – my worry is they're going to be put into place of those ships because we're not replacing them with frigates. So –
The fruits of the lords of transformation who have now retired, better people will have to fix it. On another thing of transformation, we had a good talk about Libya and it's interesting because in three jobs previously, I played around with people who are planning for this, but the PowerPoint has gone three-dimensional when it comes to UAVs. Now they call them UASs. They're great platforms if they're used correctly, but some people, they have to turn the knob to 11 and make them more than they are. But there's a great hype with unmanned systems, but there's also reality when you look at the loss rates, their exquisite comm links, and the fact that you are kind of looking through a soda straw. They have good uses, but they're not the end-all to be-all. I've read some very encouraging things coming out of Libya where people have said, hey, between Libya and Afghanistan, UASs and UAVs are really good for issues 1, 2, and 3, but 4 and 5, they're just not going to happen. So let's focus on 1, 2, and 3. How do you see the growth of UAV and UAS and how much the reality that we've been able to actually see in the last 5 or 6 years is going to be reflected in future plans?
Well, I think really they are a growth area. I think you're going to see that we see it in the role on terrorism and counterterrorism. They play a tremendous role in certain situations. They have long loiter time. You don't have to put a pilot at risk. But at the same time, I have to think that you have to consider the fact that they are vulnerable to interception. If the CIPRNet can get a virus, the U.S. military's, secret computer system can get a computer virus. If these things can happen, my guess is that, companies' websites can be hacked. I do worry that we could lose control of UAVs through cyber efforts, and that's a big concern of mine. I do think that needs to be looked at. I think it needs to, we can't completely come to rely on them so much. But I do think that there is a lot of room for growth here. I think that, what happens is as things get more and more expensive, it's going to become more and more difficult to risk pilots, and everything is going to be considered more and more high risk, and They're just not going to want to do that. They're not going to want to risk pilots. They're not going to want to send them out on 18-hour loiter missions where a UAV would be better suited. Now, there are, of course, some things like close air support, things like a gunship, an Air Force gunship, AC-130. That's a perfect example of where a manned platform does some great work. But, of course, I can see a day where even those are replaced by manned platforms, like I said, by unmanned platforms. The only thing, though, is, like I said, the data links I consider very vulnerable, maybe not very vulnerable, but still vulnerable. But I think that you're always going to want to rely, you're going to want to have a man in the loop on some of this stuff. But I think things like anti-submarine warfare, and reconnaissance, all that kind of stuff, UAVs play a very, very important role.
You know, the other day I put a blog post up about the Navy's first lighter-than-air aircraft in 50 years coming online. Now, it's experimental, but is in terms of linger time and stuff like that, is there going to be a future, in your view, in our combat fleet for lighter-than-air aircraft?
I'll tell you, I think it all comes down to cost. I think that if they can produce anything that's affordable, it will be great. The problem is, every time they produce anything, it becomes unaffordable very soon. And by the time it's ended production, it's finally become affordable, then they design something new, and that's unaffordable again. And so my feeling a lot of times is one of the problems that happen, for instance, is they'll build a ship, and they'll say this is too expensive, so we have to build a less capable model that's more affordable. Well, what they'll do is they'll spend hundreds of millions or billions of dollars developing this new platform, and it'll be less capable and less advanced than the previous one, yet it winds up costing more because of all the R&D money they put in. They might as well just have kept building the same previous platform. I've heard people make that argument about the Seawolf-class submarines to Virginias, and I've heard them make the same argument about the Ticonderogas to Arleigh Burkes, is that every time you build something new that you plan to be more affordable, a lot of times it becomes the same price as the previous version. Now, there are a lot of great things now, of course, you can say about the Arleigh Burkes and the Virginia class. They've really become upon their own. But in the beginning, there were some real, real problems. And I don't know if you guys saw this really, really interesting quote from Mitt Romney during a speech. Have you guys seen this? You've said before, I stay out of politics as part of my job. But his quote was that during World War II, we built 1,000 ships per year with 1,000 people in the Bureau of Ships. In the 80s, we built 17 ships per year with 4,000 people. And today, we build 9 ships a year with 25,000 people. That's really...
I heard about his naval speech, but I feel bad that I have not read it in detail, but I'm going to find the transcript of it because, boy, did he just nail that problem right on the head, too. That's one thing I wonder when you look at the progress they made in cruiser development in the 20s and 30s when your high-speed communication was a telegraph, there were no computers. There's something wrong. There's something very wrong.
Yeah, it really worries me because when you think about why the cost of these ships is going up so much, and you look at it, a lot of times the cost is in the people, And so what happens though is that not necessarily the people on the ship, but there's so much involved. There's such a bureaucracy. That's a very, very scary thing because that becomes self-perpetuating, and that's a very big concern of mine. Is that the military bureaucracy gets so bloated that it becomes that any type of vessel that you have to build, anything gets so big that you can't control the costs anymore.
Eric, I know Mary's listening, so I'm going to throw a bone her way here. Our sister service here in the Maritime, the Marine Corps, that we all know about the U.S. Marine Corps, but the Brits, the Royal Marines, great Royal Marine Commandos, they just don't get any better. The Dutch Marines, again, they've done some great anti-piracy stuff. But the Spains and the Italians also have some not insignificant Marine Corps attached to their Navy. Have you seen some movements and whether it's acquisitions or philosophy of the other Marine Corps with our allied nations that might be of interest and perhaps a little different from some of the emphasis we have?
Yeah, I think it's very much so. There's been this kind of growth in the amphibious assault ship, the kind of multi-purpose vessel that, you know, like the like we have the Tarawa and the Wasp class. Well, there's the Dutch have a class that's similar to that, you know, a bit smaller, but the same, you know, the British and the Spanish, the Australians are building them now, the Canberra class. And so we're seeing that, and what we're seeing is that those ships are really multi-purpose. They're really multi-purpose assault ships, and when in an emergency, they can either be filled with Marines, they can be filled with evacuees or humanitarian assistance, and that's really one of the strengths of the Marine Corps around the world, is that the Marine Corps units around the world can get in these ships, protect the assets that need to go when they get on the ground, because we all know that once the food or whatever aid gets there for humanitarian assistance, they need protection. Those environments where they're going into are very, very dangerous. And as you can see, in many areas of the world, they can't go in unescorted. And, you know, that's a perfect example. The other thing is, you know, as you see counter-piracy, you see any kind of, you know, whether it be hostage rescue or, you know, counter-terrorism efforts, the Marine Corps really is at the forefront of that because they're so close. They take the fight to the enemy. And these ships that are entering service in, you know, Australia and the Netherlands and Spain, they really are at the forefront of that. And we're seeing that really come to fruition. That was really, in many ways, after the first Gulf War, there was this kind of effort, this from the sea push, you might remember. And, you know, concepts take a long time to come to reality, and we've now seen those come to reality. Now, the thing that worries me the most, though, is 10 years ago, the push for transformation started, and I'm not sure that was so good for the navies and the large ships. And so I think we're really seeing that come now, and we're being hit by that wave, which took 10 years to come to us, and that's really the LCS, and other countries are kind of suffering some of the same after effects of the transformation push, which has not been so great for the conventional forces.
Well, speaking of large amphibious ships, what's up with the Russians buying the Mistrals? And is this just part of the trend you just described, or is this something different?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I think that really what happened was after the Russian war with Georgia, when they realized their capability would have been a lot better if they had this their ability to engage with the Georgians, engage in attack, would have been a lot better had they had this capability. I think what you're seeing is the Russian shipbuilding industry, the Russian design and development element of their naval acquisition community is completely broken, and they cannot get anything to market to operational status quickly. And if they want something quickly, they just have to go elsewhere. I think what this is a real admission that the Russian fleet and the Russian Navy is in very dire capability in terms of their ability to acquire new vessels. And while they're still limping along on their Cold War era ships, the design of new ships has been stumbling ever since the end of the Cold War. It's been so bad. Their ability to design a warship and build it and bring it into service has been minimal. I mean, you take a country, a small country like the Netherlands or Italy, that's able to do so much better, and of course than the Russians, which has historically been a real powerhouse of naval construction during the Cold War. And we're just seeing that that capability is completely atrophied to the point where they have to go to France to buy it.
Yeah, I'm gonna totally change the question I was going to ask you here, because you hit something that I asked a guest last year, and it amazes me. You have the Danes. God love them. You know, Denmark has a population, I think, 5.5 million. There's only 17 million Dutch in a nation the size of New Jersey and half of Maryland put together, I believe. But when you look at the ships that the Danes and the Dutch are building from a quality and from a utility standpoint, they're really spot on. What is it about their mentality and how they work in places that have a much higher personnel cost when it comes to their workmen to build their ships? What are they doing right that we could really learn from over here?
Yeah, the Dutch and the Danes built some amazing ships. The Seven Provinsen class frigates from the Dutch are just, they're in the process. They're trying to refit them with ballistic missile capability defense.
Yep.
The Danes have been able to get the modular designs like we've been trying to do with the LCS. They were able to get it over a decade ago with their StandFlex program. So I think some of the stuff is that whenever you aren't flush with money, you're forced to think a bit more innovatively. But I think the other element is they don't have to have the best, the very, very best. And the U.S., one of the challenges that we face is we can't be second best to anyone. We can't, the Danes and the Dutch know that in an emergency, we'll be there to catch them if they fall. We don't have that option. So what happens is we can't go for the 93 or 92 percentile. We can't say this will intercept, 75% of your targets. They have that luxury, and we don't. And that's really one of it. It comes down to what you want to do. And I think that if we wanted to, for instance, build our ships a little less able to take hits, Now, I'm not going to – you can comment on the LCS on that. I don't want to – I'll stay a little away from that because we've kind of started to cut into that leadership role we have in terms of how good our ships are. But – what happens is that they have taken risks in some ways that we would not. And if I were had a choice of being in an Arleigh Burke or a Dutch or a Danish ship when it took a missile hit, I'd prefer any day to be in a U.S. ship. And I think those are some of the things. But you're absolutely right. Those ships and those capabilities are tremendous for a country their size. They're among the very, very best in the world. And you figure the Danes and the Dutch and, all over some of these countries that you're able to see. I mean, Italy just built a great aircraft carrier, the Cavour. And you see some of these and you think, why can't we do that? Well, probably if we wanted to, we could. What happens is theirs is – the 85% solution, and ours has to be the 100% solution.
We're coming up on the end of the show, and I was going to ask you. I know that you've got this combat fleets book. I think you said it comes out at what, the end of 2012.
Yeah, right now it's scheduled for the late 2012.
What else have you got on your agenda? What can we look forward to here in the next few months from you?
Well, every month I write the Combat Fleets column on international navies for proceedings. So that keeps all the readers up to date on what's happening, and proceedings subscribers get that. And you could go to usni.org to check that out. You can also find a link on combatfleets.com to go there. But like I said, the NavalInstitute.org or USNI.org has links to all that stuff, Proceedings Magazine. Every month I have a column that updates the World Navies on that. And, of course, keep your eyes and ears on the Naval Institute's catalog because my book's going to start being advertised very, very soon, the next edition.
Eric, thanks again. It was great having you on. Very, very quick hours. I just want to emphasize to everybody, if you're not a subscriber to Proceedings and you enjoyed listening to Eric, then that should be all the reasons that you need to join the Naval Institute and get Proceedings. Eric's and a lot of his other co-writers there really get some stuff for you to chew on. Thanks a lot for coming. I look forward to having you on the show again, Eric.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good day.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you very much.
And thanks, everybody, for hearing us live. We're on archive. We'll see you next time on Midrath. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy day.
Malone wants to marry. Yeah.